many other young Russian students, he turned to Marxism, to this faith in the proletariat and in the natural progress of history. He was also inspired by what this faith promised, by its moral idealism, an end to inequality and suffering, an end to injustice, an end to violence, an end to Russia's humiliating backwardness as a nation. He joined the Jewish Socialist Bund, a Marxist party concerned with Jewish issues, and increasingly he had turned to the mainstream Marxist movement. In fact, as I mentioned last time, in 1895, helping Lenin organize the Petersburg Union of Struggle for the Liberation of the Working Class. Now Lenin, Vladimir Ulyanov, his real name, who lived from 1870 to 1924, was in many ways quite a different person than Martov, certainly from a different background. In his early youth, Lenin was actually quite uninterested in political or social questions. His father was a provincial education bureaucrat, a local education inspector. He even had vaguely liberal ideas, suggesting how widespread these ideas were, but it was not anything like the passion it was for Martov's family and Martov's community. The circumstance, though, that really awakened Lenin to politics was a shocking event that occurred in his family life. In 1887, when Lenin was 17 years old, and at this point rather uninterested in politics, his brother, his older brother Alexander, was arrested. He was put on trial, and he was convicted, justifiably it turns out, of being a member of the terrorist People's Will Party and of plotting the execution of Tsar Alexander III. He was then taken to the scaffolds in the presence of young Lenin, who wasn't called that yet, of course, and his family and others, and publicly hanged. Young Vladimir Ulyanov was shocked and angered by all this. He tried to understand what could possibly have led his brother to become a terrorist and to die for the cause. He loved his older brother. He admired him, but he had no knowledge of what his brother was involved with. And so he began sitting in his brother's room, reading all the books that were sitting there that he never had an interest in before. One that particularly impressed him, in fact, was Chernyshevsky's novel, What Is to Be Done, his utopian novel about new people daring to create a new world. And he decided to, he would become a revolutionary. Now, people who knew Lenin personally, as he began to call himself, of course, were impressed by his intense, almost violent passions as an individual. Lenin's wife, later, in fact, referred to Lenin's, the side of Lenin's personality with a French word, les rages, passions, a fury, the rages, literally. One of these rages was hunting. Lenin loved to hunt. He would spend the whole day racing about the woods, however bad the weather, searching for game until he was totally exhausted. Another one of his rages, of his rages, of his passions, was chess. There were days when he played chess from morning until night. And in fact, according to his wife, he even raved about chess while he slept. According to her, at one point, he sits up stark in bed and he shouts out, "If he moves his knight there, I'll answer with my castle." Lenin could also rage about such things as skating. He loved racing everybody on the ice. Mushroom collecting. He wouldn't stop no matter what the weather until his bag was full. But most of all, of course, Lenin raged about politics. When an idea took hold of Lenin, he was, many said, like a man obsessed, possessed, perhaps better to say. When he argued with people, he would hammer incessantly on the same point until you were convinced. You were almost exhausted by the argument. In fact, many admitted to being won over by his stubborn persistence, but also by his intensely powerful logical mind. And when Lenin criticized your arguments, he didn't just challenge you. He didn't just argue gently. He attacked ferociously. It was said that he would verbally smash the faces of his opponents, trample them underfoot, and quite effectively, too. In fact, he himself admitted occasionally, he said, "I can be a bit rabid in argument." In fact, one of his later admirers, a man you'll hear about later in this course, Joseph Stalin, liked to say that Lenin didn't speak words, he shot them out like bullets. A good early example of this is Lenin's polemic written in 1894 against the populace. This was really his first major work. It was a pamphlet called Who Are the Friends of the People?, trying to show that it's the Marxists, not the populists. And in part, this is a rather standard conventional Marxist critique of the populist faith that capitalism could be avoided or should be avoided in Russia. But there's more to this, and this is, I think, the more telling part of his argument. While Lenin is clearly passionate about many things, and especially about politics, he makes it clear from the very beginning, and this is true throughout his life, that he was not inspired by a romantic moral passion, by the sort of romantic moral passion that inspired so many revolutionaries, including his own brother, including Martov, and many other socialists in Russia. Lenin actually made it quite clear that he despised political moralizing, the sort of moralizing that, in fact, had become conventional among the intelligentsia and was widespread among the populists. In his words, all this idealistic talk, this is from this pamphlet, Who Are the Friends of the People, all the idealistic talk among the populace about progress, goodwill, the struggle against injustice, all very common populist phrases, was, in Lenin's words, nothing but nauseating liberal cretinism. And of course, one should remember where it got his brother, to the scaffolds. For Lenin, it was intense rationalism and discipline, mental, intellectual discipline that really inspired him, and he believed would save Russia and transform the world, not moralistic ideas about justice and goodness and right. Now, these different personal styles and orientations were reflected in different ideas. Consider the differences, in particular, between Lenin and Martov's ideas about democracy. This is an enormously important concept to Russians at this time. Virtually every dissenting Russian, from liberals to extreme socialists and anarchists, claimed that democracy was what it was all about. Listen to the differences. Martov, like most Russian Marxists, in fact, probably like most ordinary worker Marxists who were beginning to be attracted to the movement as well, was attracted to Marxism for among many reasons, but one of them was its democratic promise, its liberal side, one might say. Martov, like many Marxists, believed that political representation, civil freedom, such as speech, freedom of speech, and the right to have public meetings, and freedom of press, and freedom of political parties, and the right to organize unions, he believed these were good things in and of themselves. These were, as he liked to say, natural rights rooted in the human dignity of every human being, the classic theme of the intelligentsia. Though, of course, he said, as a Marxist and as a socialist, this would need to be supplemented, need to go beyond liberalism and be supplemented by real democracy, by social democracy. Social rights were needed as well as political rights. For dignity, a life of dignity also requires good living and working conditions. Now, Lenin also shared this embrace of social democracy, of the need to go beyond liberalism, but he viewed political democracy in a very different way from Martov. He made it clear that he had no sense of the absolute value of freedom and rights. There was no value inherent in these ideas. On the contrary, he liked to say Bolsheviks make no fetish of democracy. There was nothing, as it were, magical about it. One shouldn't worship it for its own sake. Rather, for Lenin, political democracy had above all instrumental value. It was a tool to help workers fight better for socialism, give them the freedom to organize, to overturn the system, to create a just social order. In other words, he viewed political democracy as valuable only from a rational, utilitarian point of view, not as Martov did, or as populists did, or as many other Marxists did, from a moral point of view, as a universal value. One expression of this, but also of Lenin's general political personality, was his almost visceral hatred of liberals and liberalism. When he wrote a polemic and used the word liberal or liberalism, this was like a dirty word. It was a condemnation of what you stood for, and he spent a great deal of time attacking liberals and liberalism. More generally, one can see this in his style of argument, which always focused on reason, on the practical benefits of democracy, never on its moral value. Now, related to these ideas about democracy is also another key concept, especially for Marxists as well as populists, the question of consciousness. In other words, how is it that ordinary people are going to somehow be able to recognize what needs to be changed in Russian society? How are they going to come to the idea that it's time to struggle against autocracy and capitalism? This was a great concern for all these radicals. Martov was one of those many Russian socialists who believed strongly in what might be called the consciousness-raising benefits of experience, at least for workers. He was quite confident that everything about workers' lives, their suffering, their hardship, the way they were treated, would eventually lead them to understanding their common class interests and to believe in socialism. Which isn't to say they didn't need organizational help. Why else form a party? And he did believe in the importance of a party. But he still had great confidence that through the process of experience and indeed of struggle, workers would come to the understanding of what needed to be done. And we see this in practice during, for example, moments of real social upheaval, such as the 1905 revolution, which I'll talk about later. Mensheviks actively organized trade unions for workers, supported workers when they wanted to go on strike, helped organize workers' clubs, and they were convinced that doing this would allow workers to experience a struggle that would develop all their mental capacity and understanding of what had to be done. They would learn from the process. This is, by the way, one of the reasons that the Mensheviks in these later years became the most popular faction among Russian Marxists. Lenin had absolutely no such confidence in the natural process of workers learning from experience. On the contrary, he made it clear he was very, very suspicious of what workers would learn from experience, which he called spontaneity, and he didn't like it. As he argued in his most famous book, the real foundation document in many ways of Bolshevism, a fairly long pamphlet that he wrote in 1902, which he called, in honor of Chernyshevsky, What is to be Done? He argued that if you left workers to themselves, they would remain narrow-minded. They would remain ignorant. They would lack consciousness because they would never be able to see past economic issues. They wouldn't understand that their interests lie in overthrowing the entire existing system and creating a socialism. As he put it in his most famous passage, exclusively by its own effort, the working class is able to develop only trade union consciousness. In other words, the conviction it's necessary to combine in unions, fight employers, strive to make government pass necessary labor legislation. Nothing else. In other words, experience would lead workers to liberalism. And for Lenin, nothing could be worse. The implications of all this, of these views, are very considerable. This led Lenin to make the argument, and this was the policy of his party, that workers as a class could not be allowed to run their own movement, ever. Nothing, in fact, more outraged him than arguments by many, many socialists, including Marxists, who, in his totally contemptuous words, gaze with awe at the posterior of the proletariat. Don't stand behind admiring how great they are. Get out in front and lead them where they don't know where to go. Ordinary workers have to be controlled and directed. And the agency of this leadership, Lenin believed, was the vanguard party. It could include workers. It could include peasants. That wasn't the key point. It was not their social origin. It was whether they were full-time committed revolutionaries, well-trained and fully understanding Marxism, and obedient to party discipline. And if they weren't, any of the above, you threw them out of the party. In other words, the party was the embodiment of the consciousness that the masses couldn't have through experience alone. Rather tellingly, this notion that the party was the repository of consciousness was expressed symbolically in 1912 when the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks were both allowed to have legal party newspapers. The Bolsheviks named their paper Pravda, the truth, because this is what they believed the party represented. The Mensheviks, by contrast, named their paper Rabochaya Gazeta, namely the workers' paper, meant to suggest that they had greater faith in the active role of workers themselves. And Martov had a rather simple and blunt view of Lenin's ideas about consciousness and spontaneity. He said that a characteristic trait of Lenin's political culture, which influenced Bolshevism, and eventually he would later say the communist state, was the fact that, as Martov put it, Lenin simply didn't trust people. In fact, Lenin felt nothing but contempt for people. Another explanation of these ideas focuses on the influence of populism on Lenin, something that a number of Marxists began to notice, and especially the influence of the terrorist People's Will Party, even though Lenin formally rejected terrorism as impractical. Like the People's Will terrorists, Lenin believed in the creative power of individuals to change history. Chernyshevsky called them new people. Lavrov called them critically thinking individuals, and Lenin called them professional revolutionaries. Same idea about the will and the power of individuals to change history, though now focused more on their rational power than on their moral conviction. And he expressed this really nicely in a famous line in What Is to Be Done. He said, "Give me a handful of revolutionaries, and I will overturn the whole of Russia." A remarkable and revealing statement, especially for a Marxist with all their theories about how history works, a remarkable statement of what might be called revolutionary hubris, revolutionary voluntarism. Now, this heritage of populism, in particular of people's will, of the terrorist branch of the populist movement, was also evident in another typical aspect of Leninism and of Bolshevik political culture as it evolved around Lenin's leadership. Lenin and the Bolsheviks liked to portray themselves as tough-minded and, in their term, hard. They were hard radicals. And this, by the way, had no small influence on their increasing popularity among Bolsheviks, among workers, especially during the hardships of World War I, a later story I'll be getting to. And this hardness of their style led to, among other things, a sort of romanticization of violence. Not terrorism, which wasn't seen as practical, but the readiness to use mass organized violence to make a revolution. Lenin liked to talk about the readiness of Bolsheviks to use what he called plebeian methods, fists and revolvers. He liked to say the proletariat was ready when the time came to roll out the guillotine. And in turn, he complained about these Mensheviks as being too soft. They lacked revolutionary spirit. They suffered from what he liked to call bourgeois spinelessness. By the way, this isn't really fair. During the revolution of 1905, for example, as we'll see later, Mensheviks organized armed groups and even went to prison for their willingness to help workers engage in insurrections. But what the Mensheviks didn't do is romanticize violence as part of the heroism of the revolutionary movement. Lenin did. And in fact, these differences led to a rather telling exchange between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. When at one point Mensheviks began to criticize all Lenin's talk about the need for violence someday by calling him and the Bolsheviks Jacobins, after the French revolutionaries who ruled with the help of the guillotine in the name of the people in France, Lenin didn't seem to mind being called a Jacobin. "These idiots," he said, "these Girondins," referring to the more moderate branch of revolutionaries, "these Girondins don't even understand. They're paying us a very nice compliment. What is Jacobinism," he said, "but, in his words, the struggle to achieve the end in view, with no shying away from drastic plebeian measures, a struggle without kid gloves, without tenderness." Later, after 1917, this willingness to use plebeian measures would lead to some rather brutal policies, as we'll see, especially when it was linked to the idea that the party, using the guillotine, using fists and revolvers and plebeian methods, was a repository of truth, indeed rational, scientific truth. But that's a later story. In the next lecture, before returning again to the history of the state amidst all this tumult, in particular to the history of the last two monarchs, we'll look at another set, quite a different alternative set of ideas and values in pre-revolutionary Russia, at another individual who had great influence over how his contemporaries viewed Russia and the world, at another vision of Russia's present and future, an influential vision. And this is that of the great writer, indeed many would call him Russia's greatest prophet, the writer Lev Tolstoy. Thank you.
Lecture 17, Lev Tolstoy.
My subject in this lecture is one of the most remarkable men in modern Russian life, a man who was both idolized as a saint, even a prophet, but also reviled as a false prophet, even as a threat to the Orthodox Christianity that was the basis of Russian's nationhood. A man who was equally a great literary figure, indeed many would say he shaped the modern world novel itself, and also a man known as a great voice in Russia's public life. Indeed, many would say Russia's conscience at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. Indeed, a man whose ideas had influence well beyond Russia itself. And this is, of course, Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy, also known as Leo Tolstoy, who lived from 1828 to 1910. Now, as you know, Russians have traditionally believed that writers should do more than just entertain. A writer must, by definition, speak the truth, stand up as a moral witness, a witness to good and evil in the world. This was the point, of course, you'll recall, of Belinsky's famous advice to Gogol, where he said one can forgive a bad book, that is, aesthetically bad, but never a pernicious book, one that is morally bad, that is bad in the ideas that it conveys. But even in this tradition of being a witness as a writer, a moral spokesman for truth, even in this tradition, Tolstoy was in many ways unique within Russia. No other Russian writer generated a civic movement that took his name. There have been no Pushkinians, there were no Gogolians, there were no Dostoevskians in terms of people taking their ideas as part of a movement. But there were, and in fact still are, Tolstoyans. Though it's worth noting that Tolstoy himself used to say, "I am Tolstoy, but I'm not a Tolstoyan." Now, Tolstoy's life helped encourage these images of him and devotion to him as a great moral figure, even a sort of national prophet. In fact, in interesting ways, Tolstoy's life can be seen as echoing the traditional Russian ideal of a saint, perhaps deliberately on his part, but certainly in the eyes of many Russians. If you read the hagiographies, the official lives of the saints that were most loved in Russian culture, such as Saint Nicholas, or the Russian saints, Saint Sergius of Radonezh, or Saint Seraphim of Sarov, certain characteristics stand out in their stories. They all were generally wealthier people who gave up their wealth and secular power. In other words, people who turned away from the secular world, the material world. They were known for their closeness to nature, to the natural world. They were known for their compassion and pity for others, especially for the suffering in the world. These are the characteristics that make the most popular Russian saints. And in many ways, Tolstoy's life, especially in his later years, exemplified these ideals, partly intentionally on his part, certainly in the eyes of so many people around him, all of which aided the particular importance he had in Russian culture. Now, if you look at Tolstoy's life, at least superficially, it seems to have three major and quite distinct periods. The first one is a youth filled with privilege and typical aristocratic dissipation. He was born, as I mentioned, in 1828. This was August 28th on the Russian calendar, but 12 days later on the European calendar, so September 9th. He was born into a family of hereditary landed aristocrats with an ancient lineage and lots of wealth and land. In fact, in Russia's estate structure, he stood above the average nobleman, hence his title of Count Tolstoy. And his early life was fairly typical of his aristocratic class in the middle part of the 19th century. He was educated at home at the family estate known as Yasnaya Polyana, which meant bright, clear fields. It's a lovely place in the south of Moscow. He was sent, after a good home education with tutors, to Kazan University, where he studied for 3 years in the 1840s, but dropped out in 1847 before ever graduating and returning to his estates. Much of his time during the next few years, as it was partly in college as well, was spent in a completely dissipated life, in Moscow and Petersburg, the place where, of course, the nobility tended to gather and play. Drinking, dancing, affairs with various women, and a great deal of gambling. A characteristic of his class. Then in 1851, thinking something else to do, he was beginning to bore of all this, he decided, as also was characteristic of many upper-class Russians in the 19th century, to join the army, where his brother already was an officer. He became an officer fairly quickly, 1854, and fought in the Crimean War. In fact, it's clear that he really loved being an officer. He didn't like so much the battles themselves. In fact, he found them quite disturbing, but he liked the status and the uniform and the glory of being an officer. Now, while there, he began to write his first fiction. And he naturally picked first his experiences as a soldier. First, stories began to appear about his time in the Caucasus, in the mountains of southern Russia, where he recalled fighting against various tribal groups. And most famously, a series of stories began to appear about the war in the Crimean Peninsula, especially the siege of Sevastopol. These writings were actually very well received. In particular, people admired the way he described the heroism of ordinary soldiers, but also they found sympathetic his descriptions of the horrors of battle. And he decided he'd actually pursue this career as a writer. So in 1856, he resigned from the army, he resigned his commission as an officer, and returned to his estate to write. And this begins the second period of his life, that of Tolstoy, the great novelist. The whole world, of course, knows about his major works of these years, his autobiographical trilogy, Childhood, Boyhood, and Youth, from the 1850s, his great epic of individuals and families during the Napoleonic Wars, War and Peace. His story, his novel, Anna Karenina, a tragic story about two marriages and the search for love and happiness that he wrote in the mid-1870s, and other lesser works, but still significant ones. Then comes the third period of his life, the most difficult in some ways to understand, which seems so totally different from the first two. Around 1878, just after he finished Anna Karenina, he passed through a very deep religious crisis that resulted in what he described as his conversion to a truer Christianity. I'll say more about the content of this Christianity later when I want to emphasize the shape of this moment. He devoted his life at this point to propagating in dozens of pamphlets. He really gave up writing great epic novels at this point, propagating his religious views and also a social ethics that was very tied up with these religious thoughts, an ethics of the simple life and nonviolence. At the same time, he tried to exemplify his new ideals in his own everyday life. Above all, he tried to live a really simple life, which he defined as a virtuous life, a life that was in touch with nature and with physical labor. So in the 1880s, he began to wear only peasant dress, no longer the dress of an aristocrat, and it was partly because he liked to say he believed that peasants were closer to nature, were more virtuous. He worked part of his own lands with his own hands. He took up physical crafts such as shoemaking, and he tried within his own house to do all his own chores, cleaning the house, washing his own clothes, emptying the chamber pot, and the like. He also refused to eat any killed animals, declaring moral compassion for life wouldn't allow him, and he became a vegetarian. He even abstained from sexual life, declaring this to be quite sinful, to the, by the way, considerable dismay of his wife, who didn't share any of these particular ideals. He even decided, to the even greater dismay of his wife, to give all his property away to the poor, and only after considerable protests by his wife and family did he agree to give it to them instead. His main concern was that he wouldn't have any property anymore. During the final years of his life, he was constantly thinking of doing more. This didn't seem enough to him. It didn't seem to achieve the goals that he was seeking. And he decided perhaps he should give everything up and become a hermit, live in a cave, live in a small hut in the woods, perhaps become a pilgrim and go from site to site in Russia. And in fact, with this aim in mind, as quite an old man, In 1910, he simply fled his estate, left his family, his wife, the world as a whole. But before he could find a place to live as a hermit, he fell quite ill. And while at a train station that was then known as Ostapova, a minor train station, now is of course known as the Tolstoy train station, he lay there for 10 days in the humble rooms of the station master, slowly dying. Already very famous at this point, the whole world began to hear about this story, and followers and admirers and journalists, including from other countries, began to gather in greater and greater numbers at this tiny little train station outside Moscow. Hourly bulletins were dispatched declaring what the state of his health was, and these were published in newspapers all around the world, and of course in Russia. And finally, on November 7th, 1910, he died. Leading many people to declare him to be a martyr and even a saint. Now, the problem with this story about the externals of Tolstoy's life is it, in many ways, I think, though true, exaggerates the breaks in his life. In particular, it exaggerates how sudden this conversion to a new way of thinking was in this so-called third period of his life, this conversion to a new religion and to a philosophy of simplicity. And the deeper story is, in fact, I think, more complicated, more interesting, and also more entwined with the ideas of his time. To see this, I think it's useful to revisit his earlier life, and of course, his writings, which are his clearest expression. In fact, it turns out that from very early in Tolstoy's life, we see that he was preoccupied with self-perfection, as we know so many educated Russians were at the time. The search for truth, for virtue, became extremely important to him, even in his late teens and early 20s. Consider, for example, this entry from his own diary. This is in the mid-1840s. He's in his early 20s, and he writes as follows. Ivanov arrived. I talked too long with him. Cowardice. I didn't go to Bleklemishev's house. Feebleness of energy. At gymnastics, I failed to walk the bars. Cowardice. I didn't do a single trick because it hurts. Softness. At Gorchakov's, I enjoyed lies. At home, I didn't study English. Lack of resolution. I got up late. Sloth. With Begachev and Islavin, I was vain. On Tverskoy Boulevard, the sort of main drag in Moscow, on Tverskoy Boulevard, I wanted to show off. And it goes on and on and on like this, as did so many entries. His diaries are also filled with enormous lists of rules, how he should be firmer, how he should work harder, how he should study better, how he shouldn't gamble as much, how he should drink less, how he should be nicer to people. And he kept breaking these rules and writing more and more lists, obsessed with a type of self-perfection, even as a young man. Most importantly, Tolstoy's search for self-understanding, moral perfection, can be seen in his stories and novels. For example, in his very first literary work, the trilogy, Childhood, Boyhood, and Youth, he takes the conventional structure of reminiscences of childhood. It's a popular thing that existed in other countries as well. But he uses it above all to explore what had already become, from his diaries, his favorite theme, himself. Psychological self-analysis of his own developing consciousness. These themes of self-examination and self-perfection are even more evident in Tolstoy's major work of his middle period, the great epic novel War and Peace, the first draft of which was completed in 1869. This book, of course, is massive, not only in pages, but in construction and conception. And many critics, in fact, including Tolstoy himself, have suggested that it's not actually a single novel in any conventional sense at all. In fact, several have argued that it's really several novels, or as literary scholars would say, novelistic genres woven together in some enormous but connected structure. And one of the genres that one finds here in War and Peace is what the Germans called at the time a Bildungsroman, a novel about a moral and psychological journey of a person to try to discover themselves and truth about the world. And in fact, this is exactly what a good part of this novel concerns. And in fact, several characters in War and Peace take this journey of Bildung, this journey of self-knowledge and discovery and enlightenment. And among these, the most important, for the most autobiographical character in War and Peace, is a man named, and his name is telling, Pierre Bezukhov. It's a wonderful name. Pierre, he's a Russian, but he has a French first name, a sense of the uprootedness and foreignness and excessive Frenchification of this character. But his last name, Bezukhov, means a man without ears, a man who cannot hear. Who cannot hear what? You can ask, perhaps, truth and about the world. And Bezukhov's journey of moral and spiritual growth takes him through a number of interesting stages, alternating, of course, with periods of absolute despair and uncertainty. He begins with a stage of sensuality and physical self-indulgence. One recognizes the autobiographical story here to some extent. He's led to greater searching for the meaning of life. He becomes a Freemason. He becomes involved in philanthropy. That leads him eventually to greater and greater mysticism. One could see this as the course followed by many intellectuals, especially in the era of the Napoleonic War, indeed in some ways by Pushkin and the Decembrists, and even to a certain extent Alexander I himself. But finally, this journey leads him beyond all these stages, and it leads him to a truth embodied in a peasant. This is typical Tolstoy. In a peasant whose name is Platon Karatayev, a man who Bezukhov shares a cell in Moscow in 1812 after they're both picked up wandering the streets of the burning city occupied by the French. Platon Karatayev, and by the way, his name, Platon, is the Russian word for the great philosopher Plato. This is obviously intentional. Platon Karatayev, this Russian Plato of the peasantry, is a natural man of the people, as he's portrayed. He exemplifies all the great principles of life, all the virtues that Tolstoy would embrace later in the 1880s and after. Simplicity, honesty, being in touch with community and a sense of community and even nation much more than simply individuality. And above all, a natural occupation. Here was a man who could hear the world, the natural world, who worked close to nature and who wasn't alien in the way that Bezukhov was. In fact, as Bezukhov, really Tolstoy, puts it in the novel, here was, in Karatayev, the personification of everything good, Russian, and strong. In the end, however, and this is telling and perhaps prophetic about Tolstoy and so many of his generation, Bezukhov still remains, even after this journey of discovery, uncertain and lost. He's not totally sure by the end of the novel that he really has found the truth. He appears to, but he doubts. He continues to doubt. And in fact, interestingly, the only character in War and Peace whose search for the truth ends in certainty that he has found the truth about the world is a character named Andrei Bolkonsky, a highly aristocratic, highly intellectual, highly sensitive individual engaged in a typical searching for the meaning of life. He finds truth, and this is telling, only when he lay on the battlefields of Austerlitz, dying, looking up at the sky. At this point, he experiences a blissful epiphany that seems to give to him the meaning of life, though, in fact, Tolstoy doesn't ever really tell us what he's discovered, except he's now dead. Now, as I've already mentioned, one of the major themes in Tolstoy's worldview, and again, from very early on, is the idealization of simplicity. He felt quite certain throughout his life that human beings were essentially born innocent, but they were gradually ruined by the institutions of civilization, especially Western European-style education that was so pervasive in Russia. The trouble with education, he said, is it was practiced everywhere in Russia, and this is before, remember, his great religious and moral conversion of the 1880s. He argued quite early that this education ruined people's natures. It blinded them to the deepest truths by all these layers of civilization. And these truths can be seen best by people who have not been corrupted, especially children, and, as he would later show in War and Peace, peasants. And you can see, of course, echoes of Slavophile arguments in all of this, especially regarding peasants. Already in the 1850s and 1860s, Tolstoy began to try to put into practice these ideas by engaging in various educational efforts on his own noble estate. He established a school for peasants, peasant boys, that is, in which he followed what was really for Russia at the time a very unusual educational method. And he wrote a great deal about it in order that people throughout Russia should hear about these things. He said, of course, one needs to teach the basic school skills in school, reading and geography and arithmetic and zoology and physics and the like. But very importantly, he argued, and tried to practice this in his schools, one has to teach without crushing the will to learn, the love of knowledge, the natural intelligence, he liked to call it, of children, their harmoniousness with nature, their harmonious relations with other people, their natural morality, even. And he elaborated this into a set of ideas even more generally, and this is in his earlier period of life. People, he argued, are basically evil in the world, and above all, miserable, not because they're ignorant, but because they're too civilized. Again, you hear the echoes of the Slavophiles. They've lost touch with natural reason and truth. And these truths, of course, include such things as justice and freedom and equality and human dignity and love, which he argued grow out of the very nature of people. They naturally crave these things, and then the more civilized they become, they begin to forget about these basic fundamental truths and hence become evil or miserable or both. And one can find these sorts of ideas in all of Tolstoy's works, including, again, as I'm emphasizing, even before his famous conversion. For example, in a novel he wrote in 1862 called The Cossacks, one meets these two Cossacks, one of them named Lukashka and the other named Uncle Yeroshka. And it's clear that these characters are morally superior and a whole lot happier than educated noblemen who they meet in the course of the novel. In fact, one of these noblemen, an officer named Olyanin, realizes how unhappy he is and how happy the Cossacks are precisely because of their simplicity. And similarly, we find in War and Peace, Pierre, and in Anna Karenina, a character named Konstantin Levin, both aristocrats, recognize the greater happiness, the greater morality, the greater harmony with the world of simple peasants and simple soldiers. Now, of course, after Tolstoy's conversion, all of these ideas about natural human values best recognized by children and peasants pervade all the pamphlets that he wrote and his late novels such as Resurrection, which he worked on throughout the 90s. Clearly, this moment of transformation was part of his whole life and, of course, connected to other ideas being discussed by other people in Russian life at the time. Another theme in his writing, worth emphasizing, and again characteristic of some people's thought at the time, is an increasing distaste for individualism. His talk about the need for self-renunciation. In fact, in different ways, most of Tolstoy's great novels make a case against the autonomous individual. Most famously, of course, in War and Peace, Tolstoy tries to argue that individuals in history, great men like Napoleon, are in fact powerless to affect the way history happens, to affect the movement of history. And, of course, the way this is set up and shown in the novel is that the greatness of the Russian commander, Mikhail Kutuzov, isn't because he challenges history, but because he understands the natural flow of events, and he works in harmony with them, rather than trying to manipulate history. Similar in the great novel Anna Karenina, we see a deep struggle within the main character, Anna, an ultimately tragic struggle, in which her individual self, which strives for freedom and happiness, personal happiness, self-expression through love, is in constant conflict with her social self, her social morality, and her need to be part of a natural community, in particular, to be a wife, to be a mother. And in fact, when she loses her last bonds to other people, to her husband, to her son, even to her lover, seen as the source of her new happiness, she's left with nothing, Tolstoy says, but her individuality, and she commits suicide. And she does so, of course, for added emphasis, under the wheels of a train at a crowded train station, the very symbol of what modern life is all about in some ways. By contrast, of course, in this novel, in Anna Karenina, Konstantin Levin, another character finds happiness by giving up all his plans for individual, personal happiness and finding real happiness in marriage and friendship and, of course, closeness to nature. Now, all of these concerns and ideas and many others led Tolstoy to think in new ways about religion. So new, in fact, that the Russian Orthodox Church excommunicated him in 1901. And for Tolstoy, official Christianity was deeply flawed. And the problem was that it masked and crushed and perverted and hid all the true meanings of life, the universal truths that come out of people's lives naturally and are at the heart of true Christianity, he said, and in fact of all religions. Thus, he argued, the real soul and heart of Christianity and the real greatness of Jesus Christ, who he argued was not a divine figure, but a man of genius, a great prophet, was that he could see through the falsehoods of civilization even in his time. And Tolstoy argued that what Jesus taught was not mystical, it wasn't mysterious, despite all the myths, he said, the church had built up around Jesus' life, but it was simple and understandable by all. And the church tried to hide these simple truths because, as Tolstoy argued, they were dangerous truths for any established power, to hide them behind ritual and dogma. For Tolstoy, the whole of Christianity and of his new religious perspective was expressed in the Sermon on the Mount, which Tolstoy summed up in a wonderful phrase in his essay, What I Believe, which he wrote in 1882 to let people know these ideas. He said, the essence of Christianity is nothing less than, his words, Christ enjoins men to refrain from stupid actions. In other words, from acts that their nature tells them are wrong. Anger or hatred or violence or murder. And inspired by this ethical reading of Christianity, Tolstoy goes on to reject just about everything the established Orthodox Church held sacred. He rejected theological dogma, the Holy Trinity, Immaculate Conception, Virgin Birth, Christ's divinity, resurrection, was all a myth to hide the fundamental ethical truth that he and many others at his time were saying is at the heart of Christianity. He also rejected the need for priests and sacraments and liturgy. For Tolstoy, the only sacrament needed was the practice of universal ideals of moral good, which are natural to people once they rediscover them. In fact, toward the end of his life, Tolstoy decided to advance these ideas by actually rewriting the Gospels to create one single narrative instead of the confusion of four that would be without anything mystical or supernatural. He felt like he had become virtually a witness himself of the moment of crucifixion and the story of Jesus, and therefore should write his own Tolstoyan gospel. Now, I want to conclude by recalling Tolstoy's comment when he says, I'm Tolstoy, I'm not a Tolstoyan. Because this, in a way, is a way of suggesting that he did, in many ways, remain a person, a man, and as such, filled with contradictions and doubt. As I've suggested, one can see in some of his closest characters in his novels, like Pierre Bezukhov. His arguments, when you take them as a whole, were often contradictory. He famously argued for quietism, for non-resistance to evil, for Christ's principle of turning the other cheek. But he also insisted that evil has to be publicly criticized as often as possible. He combined a belief in learning from common people with a conviction that they needed to be taught to see the light of truth, hence writing so many pamphlets, planning to rewrite the Gospels themselves. People needed to be persuaded. He combined a belief in absolute truths, which were natural to human beings, an idea we've seen others articulating at the time, with a conviction that their verity could never be demonstrated, that only faith ultimately brought absolute certainty. And yet, as he often argued, faith without questioning was blind faith and potentially a lie. Ultimately, in other words, he never stopped asking questions, struggling to find certainty, like so many of his literary characters, in fact. And in the end, these uncertainties led him on his final tragic journey, his decision to abandon everything and wander the country as a poor pilgrim. One interpreter of Tolstoy's life, Sir Isaiah Berlin, great intellectual historian of Russia, described this dramatic and fateful moment starkly. In his words, Tolstoy sacrificed all he had upon her altar, the altar of truth. Happiness, friendship, love, peace, moral and intellectual certainty, and in the end, life itself. And all she, all truth, gave him in return was doubt, insecurity, self-contempt, and insoluble contradictions. Perhaps in a way, this uncertainty and contradiction is really at the heart of Tolstoy's genius, and in many ways, his centrality as a man of his age, the late 19th and early 20th century of Russia. He probed much more deeply than most in searching for answers. But he was always too much of a genius to ever be certain that he found them. No less importantly, in this uncertainty, he was in many ways, perhaps tragically, characteristic of his time. Next time, I'm going to return to the state and its rulers, and to a man who seemed stubbornly certain that he did know the truth about life and the world. This was the Emperor Alexander III.
Lecture 18, The Reign of Alexander III.
We now return to the story in the powerful heights of Russian political life, to personalities and policies, ideas within the Russian state, and especially the story of its last two monarchs, Alexander III, and who I'll talk about next time, Nicholas II. Now, the reign of Alexander III was the son of Alexander II. He ruled from 1881, when his father was killed, to 1894, is often described quite simply as an era of reaction. In fact, one very influential American historian of Russia has gone even further than that and described Alexander III's reign as marking the establishment of nothing less than Russian totalitarianism. In his words, he said that Alexander III's reign established the bureaucratic police regime, which in effect has been in power there ever since. It's worth noting he was writing at the time communists were still in power. But the beginning of totalitarianism, it's often said, was to be found in the reign of Alexander III. Now, to be fair, Alexander III was not entirely opposed to all forms of change or even reform. On the contrary, like most Russian rulers, he recognized the need for national progress, even reform, in order to maintain the strength and might of the Russian nation and the state in a modern world. And there were, in fact, certain reforms during his reign, though it's worth noting that they were almost entirely economic reforms to build up the economic strength of the country and not political reforms. And this disjuncture between economic reform and political reform would remain characteristic throughout his reign and well into that of his son, Nicholas II. But there were reforms. For example, in 1883, a special bank was set up for peasants called the Peasants' Land Bank, established to provide loans to peasants to help them improve agriculture, to buy equipment for their plots, though in fact very few peasants had the capital to qualify for these loans, but it still made a difference for some. In 1885, 2 years later, he established a special bank for the gentry, realizing many gentry did not have the cash on hand to buy needed equipment to improve agriculture, and this would help them as well. In 1886, in order to improve conditions for the majority of the population, he abolished the head tax, often called the poll tax or the soul tax, established by Peter I. There were plenty other taxes to bring money into the state, but this one was seen to be one burden that could perhaps be alleviated to help the peasantry survive. Most importantly, under the direction of a series of reform-minded ministers of finance, he engaged in active efforts to stimulate industrial growth in the country, industrial modernization, and most notably through a massive project of building railroads all throughout the country. And railroads would generate all sorts of industries to produce for the railroads, as well as would enhance the transportation to move products. And, of course, the most famous railroad project of Alexander III's reign was starting the building of the Trans-Siberian Railway. Now, these positive reforms were not unimportant, but they were, at least in the minds of most, and I think in reality in the minds of most historians as well, overshadowed by what became known as Alexander III's counter-reforms, efforts to undo the great reforms in certain ways. You'll recall that from the very moment when Alexander came to the throne, he was faced with his father's gruesome and brutal death by a bomb. Indeed, he was waiting in the palace when his father was brought back, where he saw him with his legs blown off, soon to die, a bomb planted by a member of the terrorist People's Will Party. He was faced also with plans to introduce major political and civic reforms suggested by Loris Melikov, approved by his father Alexander II, which would have in many ways begun the process of democratizing Russian political life. Alexander III immediately declared all talk of reform under such conditions to be, in his words you'll recall, a criminal and hasty step. But he didn't just stop with undoing his father's last efforts. He went further with a whole series of counter-reforms designed to better control and manage society that seemed increasingly dangerous. Reforms or counter-reforms designed to minimize the disorder and the danger that to some degree was created by the liberalizing great reforms of Alexander II. The most important of these were what were known as the temporary regulations of 1881. Not particularly temporary because they lasted until the monarchy fell in 1917. And these regulations created conditions of virtual martial law in the country that could be used by the government whenever it wanted. Searches, arrests, imprisonment, exile could all be accomplished without recourse to the courts at all. In other words, an emphasis on the personal rule of the state, of the Tsar, being more important than any laws or institutions such as the courts. The censorship code was also strengthened in order to more severely punish dissent once it appeared in the press and more intensely censor those parts of publications that were still allowed to go before preliminary censorship, especially newspapers. And in fact, it's clear that Alexander III had a particular hostility to the press, which he at one point in describing publications described the whole publishing industry as mangy and swinish. In 1884, another of his important counter-reforms was to abolish university autonomy. If the press was mangy and swinish, the universities and its students and its faculty were no better, indeed probably worse. This autonomy established in the 1860s was completely ended. All activity within the university was totally under the control of the state now, through a special bureaucracy. Alexander III also wanted to increase bureaucratic control over other important institutions of civic independence in Russian life, especially the zemstvos, established again as part of the great reforms, and the peasant communes, which were becoming more and more important now that serfdom was ended. Special bureaucratic officials called land captains were created in 1889, essentially rural bosses working for the central state whose job was to oversee what went on in the communes and in the zemstvos. A little later, deciding this wasn't enough, in the early 1890s, the government decided to further institutionalize control over especially the zemstvos, which worried them as bastions of liberal idea and civic involvement. The role of peasants was decreased. They were only allowed, in fact, to elect nominees, and the government would choose who their representatives of the zemstvos would be. And even the very officers chosen by the nobility for the zemstvos had to now be approved and supervised by the state, and the highest officials had to be chosen by the central government. Similarly, and in very similar ways, bureaucratic supervision of city councils, the equivalent to the zemstvos in the city, was also increased. And again, to make sure that it was only loyal groups that were represented, if one could find any, but the assumption was the richest and most elite, nobles would be the most loyal, the franchise to these city councils was greatly restricted, such that